Around Harlem, the narcotics squad detectives didn't take long to find out I was selling reefers, and occasionally one of them would follow me. Many a peddler was in jail because he had been caught with the evidence on his person. I figured a way to avoid that. The law specified that if the evidence wasn't actually in your possession, you couldn't be arrested. Hollowed out shoe heels, fake hat linings, these things were old stuff to the detectives. I carried about 50 sticks in a small package inside my coat, under my armpit, keeping my arm flat against my side. Moving about, I kept my eyes open. If anybody looked suspicious, I'd quickly cross the street or go through a door or turn a corner, loosening my arm enough to let the package drop. At night, when I usually did my selling, any suspicious person wouldn't be likely to see the trick. If I decided I had been mistaken, I'd go back and get my sticks. However, I lost many a stick this way. Sometimes I knew I had frustrated a detective, and I kept out of the courts. One morning, though, I came in and found signs that my room had been entered. I knew it had been detectives. I'd heard too many times how if they couldn't find any evidence, they would plant some. Well, you would never find it, then they'd come back in and find it. I didn't even have to think twice what to do. I packed my few belongings and never looked back. When I went to sleep again, it was in another room. It was then that I began carrying a little 25 automatic. I got it for some reefers from an addict who I knew had stolen it somewhere. I carried it pressed under my belt right under the center of my back. Someone had told me that the cops never hit there in a routine patting down, and unless I knew who I was with, I never allowed myself to get caught in any crush of people. The narcotics cops had been known to rush up and get their hands on you and plant evidence while searching. I felt that as long as I kept on the go and in the open, I had a good chance. I don't know now what my real thoughts were about carrying the pistol, but I imagine I felt that I wasn't going to get put away if somebody tried framing me in any situation that I could help. I sold less than before because of having to be so careful, consume so much time. Every now and then, on a hunch, I'd move to another room. I told nobody but Sammy where I slept. Finally, it was on the wire that the Harlem Narcotics Squad had me on its special list. Now, every other day or so, usually in some public place, they would flash the badge and search me. But I'd tell them at once, loud enough for others standing about to hear me, that I had nothing on me and I didn't want to get anything planted on me. Then they wouldn't, because Harlem already thought little enough of the law, and they did have to be careful that some crowd of Negroes would not intervene roughly. Negroes were starting to get very tense in Harlem. One could almost smell trouble ready to break out, as it did very soon. But it was really tough on me then. I was having to hide my sticks in various places near where I was selling. I put 5 sticks in an empty cigarette pack and dropped the empty-looking pack by a lamppost or behind a garbage can or a box. And I'd first tell my customers to pay me and then where to pick up. But my regular customers didn't go for that. You couldn't expect a well-known musician to go grubbing behind a garbage can. So I began to pick up some of the street trade. The people you could see looked high. I collected a number of empty Red Cross bandage boxes and used them for drops. That worked pretty good. But the Middle Harlem Narcotics Force found so many ways to harass me that I had to change my area. I moved down to Lower Harlem around 110th Street. There were more reefer smokers around there, but these were a cheaper type. This is the worst of the ghetto, the poorest people, the ones who in every ghetto kept themselves narcotized to keep from having to face their miserable existence. I didn't last long down there, either. I lost too much for my product. After I sold to some of those reefer smokers who had the instincts of animals, they followed me and learned my pattern. They'd dart out of a doorway, I'd drop my stuff, and they would be on like a chicken on corn. When you become an animal, a vulture in the ghetto, as I had become, you enter a world of animals and vultures. It becomes truly the survival of only the fittest. Soon I found myself borrowing little stakes from Sammy, from some of the musicians, enough to buy supplies, enough to keep high myself, enough sometimes just to eat. Then Sammy gave me an idea. Red, you still got your old railroad identification? I did have it. They hadn't taken it back. Well, why don't you use it to make a few runs until the heat cools? He was right. I found that if you walked up and showed a railroad line's employee identification card, The conductor, even a real cracker if you approached him right, not begging, would just wave you aboard. And when he came around, he would punch you one of those little coach seat slips to ride wherever the train went. The idea came to me that this way I could travel all over the East Coast selling reefers among my friends who were on tour with their bands. I had the New Haven identification. I worked a couple of weeks for other railroads to get their identification, and then I was set. In New York, I rolled and packed a great quantity of sticks and sealed them into jars. Looking perfectly. If you had to go home on some family business, I don't give Negro credit for having sense enough to fool him. My friends were playing. Red! I'm moving from home. In the sticks, my man! Oh! At Apple Reefers. Nobody had ever heard of him. I followed him. Each band's knew the other band's one-nighter touring schedules. When I ran out of supplies, I'd return to New York and I'd load up, then hit the road again. Auditoriums or gymnasiums all lighted up, the band's chartered bus outside, the dressed-up, excited local dancers pouring in. At the door, I'd announce that I was some bandman's brother. In most cases, they thought I was one of the musicians. Throughout the dance, I'd show the country folks some plain and fancy lindy hopping. Sometimes I'd stay overnight in a town. Sometimes I'd ride the band's bus to the next stop. Sometimes back in New York, I would stay a while. Things would cool down. Word was around that I had left town, and the narcotics squad was satisfied with that. In some of the small towns, people thinking I was with the band even mobbed me for autographs. Once in Buffalo, my suit was nearly torn off. My brother Reginald was waiting for me one day when I pulled into New York. The day before, his merchant ship had put into port over in New Jersey. Thinking I still worked at Small's, Reginald had gone there, and the bartenders had directed him to Sammy, who put him up. It felt good to see my brother. It was hard to believe that he was once the little kid who tagged after me. Reginald now was almost 6 feet tall, but still a few inches shorter than me. His complexion was darker than mine, but he had greenish eyes and a white streak in his hair, which was otherwise dark reddish, something like mine. I took Reginald everywhere, introducing him. Studying my brother, I liked him. He was a lot more self-possessed than I had been at 16. I didn't have a room right at the time, but I had some money, so did Reginald, and we checked into the St. Nicholas Hotel on Sugar Hill. It has since been torn down. Reginald and I talked all night about the Lansing years, about our family. I told him things about our father and mother that he couldn't remember. Then Reginald filled me in on our brothers and sisters. Wilfred was a trade instructor at Wilberforce University. Hilda, still in Lansing, was talking of getting married, so was Filbert. Reginald and I were the next two in line, and Yvonne, Wesley, and Robert were still in Lansing in school. Reginald and I laughed about Filbert, who the last time I had seen him had gotten deeply religious. He wore one of those round straw hats. Reginald's ship was in for about a week getting some kind of repairs on its engines. I was pleased to see that Reginald, though he said little about it, admired my living by my wits. Reginald dressed a little too loudly, I thought. I got a reefer customer of mine to get him a more conservative overcoat and suit. I told Reginald what I had learned, that in order to get something, you had to look as though you already had something. Before Reginald left, I urged him to leave the Merchant Marine and I would help him get started in Harlem. I must have felt that having my kid brother around me would be a good thing. Then there would be two people I could trust. Sammy was the other. Reginald was cool. At his age, I would have been willing to run behind the train to get to New York and to Harlem. But Reginald, when he left, said, I'll think about it. Not long after Reginald left, I dragged out the wildest zoot suit in New York. This was 1943. The Boston Draft Board had written me at Ella's, and when they had no results there, had notified the New York Draft Board, and in care of Sammy, I received Uncle Sam's greetings. In those days, only three things in the world scared me. Jail, a job, and the army. I had about 10 days before I was to show up at the induction center. I went right to work. The army intelligence soldiers, those black spies in civilian clothes, hung around in Harlem with their ears open for the white man downtown. I knew exactly where to start dropping the word. I started noising around that I was frantic to join the Japanese army. When I sensed that I had the ears of the spies, I would talk and act high and crazy. A lot of Harlem hustlers actually had reached that state, as I would later. It was inevitable when one had gone long enough on heavier and heavier narcotics and under the steadily tightening vice of the hustling life. I'd snatch out and read my greetings aloud to make certain they heard who I was and when I'd report downtown. This was probably the only time my real name was ever heard in Harlem in those days. The day I went down there, I costumed like an actor. With my wild zoot suit, I wore the yellow knob-toe shoes, and I frizzled my hair up into a reddish bush of conch. I went in, skipping and tipping, and I thrust my tattered greetings at the reception desk's white soldier. Crazy old daddy-o, get me moving. I can't wait to get in that brown. Very likely that soldier hasn't recovered from me yet. They had their wire on me from uptown, all right. They still put me through the line. In that big starting room were 40 or 50 other prospective inductees. The room had fallen vacuum quiet with me running my mouth a mile a minute, talking nothing but slang. I was going to fight on all fronts. I was going to be a general man before I got done. Such talk as that. Most of them were white, of course. The tender-looking ones appeared ready to run from me. Some others had that vinegary, worst kind of nigger look, and a few were amused seeing me as the Harlem jigaboo archetype. Also amused were some of the room's 10 or 12 Negroes, but the stony-faced rest of them looked as if they were ready to sign up to go off killing somebody. They would have liked to start with me. The line moved along. Pretty soon, stripped to my shorts, I was making my eager-to-join comments in the medical examination rooms, and everybody in the white coats that I saw had 4F in his eyes. I stayed in the line longer than I expected before they siphoned me off. One of the white coats accompanied me around a turning hallway. I knew we were on the way to a head shrinker, the army psychiatrist. The receptionist there was a Negro nurse. I remember she was in her early 20s and not bad to look at. She was one of those Negro firsts. Negroes know what I'm talking about. Back then, the white man during the war was so pressed for personnel that he began letting some Negroes put down their buckets and mops and dust rags and use a pencil or sit at some desk or hold some 25-cent title. You couldn't read the Negro press for the big pictures of smug black firsts. Somebody was inside with the psychiatrist. I didn't even have to put on any act for this black girl. She was already sick of me. When finally a buzz came at her desk, she didn't send me. She went in. I knew what she was doing. She was going to make clear in advance what she thought of me. This is still one of the black man's big troubles today. Some of those so-called upper-class Negroes are so busy trying to impress on the white man that they are different from those others, that they can't see that they are only helping the white man to keep his low opinion of all Negroes. And then, with her prestige in the clear, she came out and nodded to me to go in. I must say this for that psychiatrist. He tried to be objective and professional in his manner. He sat there and doodled with his blue pencil on a tablet, listening to me spiel to him for 3 or 4 minutes before he got a word in. His tack was quiet questions to get at why I was so anxious. I didn't rush him. I circled and hedged, watching him closely to let him think he was pulling what he wanted out of me. I kept jerking around backward as though somebody might be listening. I knew I was going to send him back to the books to figure out what kind of case I was. Suddenly, I sprang up and peeped under both doors, the one I'd entered and another that probably was a closet, and then I bent and whispered fast in his ear, "Daddy-o, now, you and me, we're from up north here, so don't you tell nobody. I want to get sent down south. Organize them nigger soldiers, you dig? Steal us some guns and kill up some crackers." That psychiatrist's blue pencil dropped, and his professional manner fell off in all directions. He stared at me as if I were a snake's egg hatching, fumbling for his red pencil. I knew I had him. I was going back out past Miss First when he said, "That will be all." A 4F card came to me in the mail. and I never heard from the Army anymore and never bothered to ask why I was rejected.
Malcolm's career as a traveling reefer salesman came to an abrupt end when he pulled a gun on another railroad worker in a poker game dispute at Grand Central Station. He was blackballed by the railroads and banned from the station by the police. Back on the streets of Harlem, looking for a hustle, Malcolm turned to armed robbery. He keyed himself up for jobs with drugs and stayed high the rest of the time to keep from getting nervous. Sometimes he worked alone, sometimes with Sammy the Pimp. Reginald came to town again, and this time Malcolm convinced him to stay. They got an apartment together, and Malcolm proudly showed his little brother around, introducing him to his famous musician friends, taking him to after-hours clubs like Creole Bill's, Jimmy's Chicken Shack, and Dickie Wells. After the rest of New York had closed for the night, these spots would still be jumping, packed tight with white people out to get a taste of Harlem. Malcolm was playing the numbers heavily at this time, placing his bets with West Indian Archie, one of Harlem's legendary bad guys, a former strong-arm for Dutch Schultz. Archie was a natural for the numbers racket. He had a photographic memory, so he never had to write the numbers down. The police would never catch Archie carrying betting slips. Forced to lay low following a robbery attempt that went bad, Malcolm became a steerer for a Harlem madam, picking up and delivering her wealthy white clientele, many of them rich, influential, famous men who wanted bizarre sexual experiences with black hookers. Malcolm came to know the flesh trade well. He also steered occasionally for a white lesbian who ran a stable of black male prostitutes catering exclusively to white women. Malcolm's steady diet of cocaine, opium, alcohol, and marijuana began to take its toll. He caught colds that he couldn't shake. He stayed high continually, living in a dream world. But it was about to turn into a nightmare that not even the drugs could obscure.
Up in the Bronx, a Negro held up some Italian racketeers in a floating crap game. I heard about it on the wire. Whoever did it, aside from being a fool, was said to be a tall, light-skinned Negro masked with a woman's stocking. Up in Fat Man's Bar on the hill overlooking the polo grounds, I had just gone into a telephone booth. Everyone in the bar, all over Harlem, in fact, was drinking up excited about the news that Branch Rickey, the Brooklyn Dodgers owner, had just signed Jackie Robinson to play in Major League Baseball with the Dodgers farm team in Montreal, which replaced the time in the fall of 1945. Early in the afternoon, I had collected from West Indian Archie for a 50-cent combination bet. He had paid me $300 right out of his pocket. I was telephoning Jean Parks. Jean was one of the most beautiful women who ever lived in Harlem. She once sang with Sarah Vaughan in the Blue Bonnets, a quartet that sang with Earl Hines. For a long time, Jean and I had enjoyed a stand-in friendly deal that we'd go out and celebrate when either of us hit the numbers. Since my last hit, Jean had treated me twice, and we laughed on the phone, glad that now I'd treat her to a night out. We arranged to go to a 52nd Street nightclub to hear Billie Holiday, who had been on the road and was just back in New York. As I hung up, I spotted the two lean, tough-looking paisanos gazing in at me cooped up in the booth. I didn't need any intuition, and I had no gun. A cigarette case was the only thing in my pocket. I started easing my hand down into my pocket to try bluffing, and one of them snatched open the door. They were dark, olive, swarthy-featured Italians. I had my hand down into my pocket. "Come outside, we'll hold court," one said. At that moment, a cop walked through the front door. The two thugs slipped out. I never in my life have been so glad to see a cop. I was still shaken when I got to the apartment of my friend Sammy the Pimp. He told me that not long before, West Indian Archie had been there looking for me. Sometimes recalling all of this, I don't know to tell the truth how I am alive to tell it today. They say God takes care of fools and babies. I've so often thought that Allah was watching over me. Through all of this time in my life, I really was dead. Mentally dead. I just didn't know that I was. Anyway, to kill time, Sammy and I sniffed some of his cocaine until the time came to pick up Jean Parks to go down and hear Lady Day. Sammy's having told me about West Indian Archie looking for me didn't mean a thing. Not right then. There was the knocking at the door. Sammy, lying on his bed in pajamas and bathrobe, called, "Who?" When West Indian Archie answered, Sammy slid the round, two-sided shaving mirror under the bed, with what little of the cocaine powder, or crystals actually, was left, and I opened the door. "Red, I want my money." A .32-20 is a funny kind of gun. It's bigger than a .32. It's not as big as a .38. I had faced down some dangerous Negroes, but no one who wasn't ready to die messed with West Indian Archie. I couldn't believe it. He truly scared me. I was so incredulous at what was happening, it was hard to form words with my brain and my mouth. "Man, what's the beef?" "West Indian Archie said he thought I was trying something when I told him I'd hit, but he'd paid me the $300 until he could double-check his written betting slips. And as he claimed, but another..." "Man, you're crazy!" I talked fast. I'd seen out of the corner of my eye Sammy's hand easing under his pillow where he kept his Army 45. "Archie, smarter man as you're supposed to be, you'd pay somebody who hadn't hit?" The .32-20 moved, and Sammy froze. West Indian Archie told him, "I ought to shoot you right through the ear." I must have shaken my head. "I'll give you until 12 o'clock tomorrow." And he put his hands. The money wasn't the problem. I still had about $200 of it. Had money been the issue, Sammy could have made up the difference. If it wasn't in his pocket, his women could quickly have raised it. West Indian Archie himself, for that matter, would have loaned me $300 if I'd asked him, as many thousands of dollars of mine as he'd gotten 10% of. Once, in fact, when he'd heard I was broke, he had looked me up and handed me some money and grunted, "Stick." The issue was the position which his action had put us both into. For Hustler in our sidewalk jungle world, face and honor were important. No hustler could have it known that he'd been hyped, meaning outsmarted or made a fool of. And worse, a hustler could never afford to have it demonstrated that he could be bluffed, that he could be frightened by a threat, that he lacked nerve. West Indian Archie knew that some young hustlers rose in stature in our world when they somehow hoodwinked older hustlers, then put it on the wire for everyone to hear. He believed I was trying that. In turn, I knew he would be protecting his stature by broadcasting all over the wire his threat to me. Because of this code, in my time in Harlem, I'd personally known a dozen hustlers who threatened, left town disgraced. Once the wire had it, any retreat by either of us was unthinkable. The wire would be awaiting the report of the showdown. Known of at least another dozen showdowns in which one took the dead on arrival ride to the morgue, and the other went to prison for manslaughter or the electric chair for murder. He let me hold his .32. My guns were at my apartment. I put the .32 in my pocket, with my hand on it, and walked out. I couldn't stay out of sight. I had to show up at all of my usual haunts. I was glad that Reginald Town, he might have tried protecting me, and I didn't want him shot in the head by West Indian Archie. It was just about time for me to go and pick up Gene Parks to go downtown to see Billie Holiday at the Onyx Club. So much was swirling in my head. I thought about telephoning her and calling it off, making some excuse. But I knew that running now was the worst thing I could do. So I went on and picked up Gene at her place, who took a taxi down to 52nd Street. Billie, at the microphone, had just finished a number when she saw Gene and me. Her white gown glittered under the spotlight. Her face had that coppery, Indianish look, and her hair was in that trademark ponytail. For her next number, she did the one. When her set was done, Billie came over to our table. She and Gene, who hadn't seen each other in a long time, hugged each other. Billie sensed something wrong with me. She knew that I was always high, but she knew me well enough to see that something else was wrong, and she asked me in her customary profane language what was the matter with me. In my own foul vocabulary of those days, I pretended to be without a care, so she let it drop. We had a picture taken by the club photographer that night. The three of us were sitting close together. That was the last time I ever saw Lady Day. She's dead. Dope and heartbreak stopped that heart as big as a barn in that sound and style that no one successfully copies. Lady Day sang with the soul of Negroes from the centuries of sorrow and oppression. What a shame that proud, fine black woman never lived where the true greatness of the black race was appreciated. In the Onyx Club men's room, I sniffed a little pen from Sammy. Jean and I, riding back up to Harlem in a cab, decided to have another drink. She had no idea what was happening when she suggested one of my men, and I said, okay. By the time we'd had the drink, I was so high that I asked Jean to take a cab on home, and she did. I never have seen Jean again either. Like a fool, I didn't leave the bar. I stayed there, sitting again. But it's a good thing I was then. I'm positive if I'd seen West Indian Archie come in, I'd have shot to kill. The next thing I knew, West Indian Archie was standing before me, cursing me loud, his gun on me. He was really making his public point, floor showing for the people. He called me foul names, threatened me. Everyone, bartenders, customers, sat or stood as though carved. Drinks in midair. The jukebox in the rear was going. I had never seen West Indian Archie high before. Not a whiskey high. I could tell it was something else. I knew the hustler's characteristic of keying up on dope to do a job. I was thinking, I'm going to kill Archie. I'm just going to wait until he turns around to get the drop on him. I could feel my own .32 resting against my ribs where it was tucked under my belt, beneath my coat. West Indian Archie, seeming to read my mind, quit cursing, and his words jarred me. You're thinking you're going to kill me first, Red. But I'm going to give you something to think about. I'm 60. I'm an old man. I've been to Sing Sing. My life is over. You're a young man. Kill me, you're lost anyway. All you can do is go to prison. I've since thought that West Indian Archie may have been trying to scare me into running to save both his face and his life. It may be that's why he was so high. No one knew that I hadn't killed anyone, but no one who knew me, including myself, would doubt that I'd kill. I can't guess what might have happened. But under the code, if West Indian Archie had gone out the door after having humiliated me as he did, I'd have had to follow him out. We'd have shot it out in the street. But some friends of West Indian Archie moved up alongside me, calling, Archie. Archie! And he let them put their hands on him. And they drew him aside. I watched them move him past where I was sitting, glaring at me. They're working him back toward the rear. I got down off the stool. I dropped a bill on the bar for the bartender. Without looking back, I went out. I stood outside in full view of the bar with my hand in my pocket for perhaps 5 minutes. When West Indian Archie didn't come out, I left. It must have been 5 a.m. when downtown I woke up a white actor I knew who lived in the Howard Hotel on 45th Street off 6th Avenue. I knew I had to stay high. The amount of dope I put into myself within the next several hours sounds inconceivable. I got some opium from that fellow. I took a cab back to my apartment and I smoked it. I heard a mosquito cough. My telephone rang. It was the white lesbian who lived downtown. She wanted me to bring her and her girlfriend $50 worth of reefers. I felt that I'd always done it. I had to do it now. Opium had me drowsy. I had a bottle of Benzedrine tablets in my bathroom. I swallowed some of them to perk up. The two drugs working in me had my head going in opposite directions at the same time. I knocked at the apartment right behind mine. The dealer let me have loose marijuana on credit. He saw I was so high that he even helped me roll it, 100 sticks. And while we were rolling it, we both smoked some. Now, opium, Benzedrine, reefers. I stopped by Sammy's on the way downtown. Sammy was by this time very badly addicted. He seemed hardly to recognize me. Lying in bed, he reached under again and brought out that inevitable shaving mirror on which, for some reason, he always kept his cocaine crystals. He motioned for me to sniff some. I didn't refuse. Going downtown to deliver the reefers, I felt sensations I cannot describe in all those different grooves at the same time. The only word to describe it was timelessness. A day might have seemed to me 5 minutes, or a half hour might have seemed a week. I can't imagine how I looked when I got to the hotel. When the lesbian and her girlfriend saw me, they helped me to a bed. I fell across it and passed out. That night, when they woke me up, it was half a day beyond West Indian Archie's deadline. I went back uptown. It was on the wire. I could see people who knew me finding business elsewhere. I knew nobody wanted to be caught in a crossfire. But nothing happened. Next day either. I just stayed high. Some raw kid hustling in the bar I had to bust in his mouth. He came back pulling a blade. I would have shot him, but somebody grabbed him. They put him out, cursing that he was going to kill me. Intuition told me to get rid of my gun. I gave a hustler the eye across the bar. I'd no more slipped him the gun from my belt when a cop I'd seen about came in the other door. He had his hand on his gun butt. He knew it was all over the wire. He was certain I'd be armed. He came slowly over toward me, and I knew if I sneezed, he'd blast me down. He said, "Take your hand out of your pocket, Red, real carefully." I did. Once he saw me empty-handed, we both could relax a little. He motioned for me to walk outside ahead of him, and I did. I'd walk opposite their patrol car, double-parked with its radio going. With people stopping, looking, they pan there on the sidewalk. "What are you looking for?" I asked them when they didn't find anything. "Red, there's a report you're carrying a gun." "I had one," I said, "but I threw it in the river." The one that'd come into the bar said, "I think I'd leave town if I were you, Red." I went back to the bar. Saying that I had thrown my gun away had kept them from taking me to my apartment. Things I had there could have gotten me more time than 10 guns and could have gotten them a promotion. Everything was building up, closing in on me. I was trapped in so many cross turns. West Indian Archie gunning for me, the Italians who thought I'd stuck up their crap game after me, the scared kid hustler I'd hit, the cops. For 4 years up to that point, I'd been lucky enough or slick enough to escape jail or even getting arrested or any serious trouble. But I knew that any minute now, something had to give. Sammy had done something for me I've often wished I could have thanked him for. When I heard the car's horn, I was walking on St. Nicholas Avenue, but my ears were hearing a gun. I didn't dream the horn could possibly be for me. "Homeboy!" I jerked around. I came close to shooting. "Shorty! From Boston!" I'd scared him nearly. Ooh. I couldn't have been happier. Inside the car, he told me Sammy had telephoned about how I was jammed up tight and told him he'd better come and get me. And Shorty did his band's date, then borrowed his piano man's car and burned up the miles to New York. I didn't put up any objections to leaving. Shorty stood watch outside my apartment. I brought out and stuffed into the car's trunk what little stuff I cared to hang on to. Then we hit the highway. 36 hours. He told me afterward that through just about the whole ride back, I talked out of my head.
Back in Boston again, even Shorty was amazed and a bit frightened by the animal edge that Malcolm had developed on the streets of Harlem. The hustlers of Roxbury learned quickly that Detroit had a gun and was crazy enough to use it. Malcolm was looking for a new hustle, and this time he settled on house burglary. He began recruiting people to join him, starting with Shorty, who was tired of just getting by on his earnings as a musician. Shorty also brought in a friend named Rudy. Sophia, Malcolm's white girlfriend from his earlier days in Boston, also joined. She was married now, but her husband was away most of the business. Sophia completed the group when she brought in her younger sister. Malcolm found an apartment in Harvard Square that served as their base of operations. Posing as saleswomen, poll takers, or whatever seemed suitable, the two women would scout wealthy white neighborhoods for the best houses to burglarize. Malcolm and Shorty would do the job, breaking in with lock picks or entering through a window. Rudy drove the getaway car. The Ring operated through the winter of 1945, cashing in heavily during the Christmas season. Malcolm continued to boost his courage with heavy doses of drugs. "I had gotten to the point," he said, "where I was walking on my own coffin."